Actually, this is a talk I plan to present at Walter Strauss's 70th birthday, but I injured my knee and couldn't travel, so it's for both of you. Now, the spectral representation of a self-adjoint operator in Hilbert space represents the Hilbert space as a product of L2 spaces with respect to measures MJ, so that in this representation the action of the operator A is just multiplication by X, and therefore the action of the group generated by IA exponentially is just multiplication by e to the IXT. Now take the special case that all the MJs are Lebesgue measure. Then the spectral representation can be thought of as representing the Hilbert space as the L2 space of vector-valued functions. And if you take now a Fourier transform of that, then the group generated, which is represented by multiplication by e to the ixt in the spectral representation, becomes translation by t. And that's called the translation representation. Of course, conversely, if you have a translation representation, then the Fourier inverse is a spectral representation. Now, it turns out that in a number of interesting cases, you have precisely this situation of uniform Lebesgue measure, and the translation representation can be constructed in a particularly simple and geometric fashion. And I would like to describe such a case. Now, this sounds suspiciously linear, so it didn't fit into the theme of the conference, but at the very end, there is a very beautiful purely geometric problem, which is non-linear as all geometric problems are.
But linear is always the limiting case of non-linear.
So the situation I want to present is from hyperbolic in the hyperbolic plane, and let me remind you, this is the Poincaré model, the upper half plane with the Poincaré metric. The geodesics are circles which are perpendicular to y equals zero. The hyperbolic motions are fractional linear transformations. The invariant L2 integral is with a weight 1 over y square. The invariant Dirichlet integral is just the older Dirichlet integral, and therefore the hyperbolic Laplacian is just y square times the Euclidean Laplacian. Now, the spectral. So I will be addressing the problem of finding spectral representation for the hyperbolic Laplacian. So let me for a moment speak about the whole hyperbolic plane. Now, in the Euclidean case, the representation is just Fourier representation with a factor e to the I x c, and these functions satisfy the dx square is just multiplication by minus c square. So now, of course, every function of the form e to the a times x is an eigenfunction of the one-dimensional Laplacian, but one picks a to be purely imaginary because you want functions which are, they couldn't be square integrable, since this is continuous spectrum, but they shouldn't be too badly non-square integrable. So let me make use of this principle. The analog of e to the ax is y, just y to the a, and if you apply the hyperbolic Laplacian, you get a times a minus 1. Now, this is not square integrable. If you try to square integrate it, you get into trouble. But I say that the real part of a should be so chosen that this should be just barely not square integral both at zero and infinity, and that's 1 over y. So y to the twice real part of a minus 2 has to be y to the minus 1, which makes the real part of a equal to 1/2. So a is 1/2 plus ib, and the spectrum a times a minus 1 turns out to be minus 1/4 minus b square. So that shows that the spectrum of this operator is from minus infinity to minus 1/4. Now, in case you don't believe this derivation, it's a little bit dubious. Let me give a better one. And it is this, that the hyperbolic Laplacian plus 1/4 is negative. So it boils down to this inequality up there, and we have a negative term, so it's not quite clear why this is so, but if you take the positive term u sub y squared combined with the negative term, it can be written in a form that displays its positivity. And the proof of the positivity is just to carry out the differentiation, you get that, you square it, you get these terms, and you integrate by parts the cross term, and you get the identity. So that's better, isn't it? Now, actually, we are not interested in the spectral representation of the hyperbolic Laplacian over the whole hyperbolic plane, but over a fundamental domain with respect to a discrete subgroup. And what's a discrete subgroup? It's a subgroup of motions which have the property that the orbit of any point accumulates only at infinity. And so the analog of that in the Euclidean case is translation by integers in x and y, for instance. And every point in the Euclidean plane can be brought back to a period parallelogram. So functions which are invariant under this group can be thought of as functions defined on a period parallelogram which satisfy boundary conditions, boundaries match up. And the same is true in the hyperbolic case. There are three cases. If the group gamma is large, then the fundamental domain is small, compact. If gamma is of medium size, then the fundamental domain is of medium size, which means it's not compact but has finite area. And if the group gamma is small, then the fundamental domain is large, infinite area. And so it's, as in all fairy tales, it's the medium case that is of interest, of greatest interest. And the classical example of a medium-sized group is the modular group. The subgroup gamma which generates it is all fraction linear transformation is A, B, C, D integers. The fundamental domain of this group is, as shown in that crudely drawn diagram, I'll put it down here. Here is the hyperbolic plane, this is the origin, this is the geodesic, the unit circle, this is 1/2, and the fundamental domain is up here. This result goes essentially back to Gauss in another context. So the theorem is that, and then later on I will talk about other groups, discrete groups, but for this one, the spectral theorem says that the hyperbolic Laplacian acting on automorphic functions with respect to the modular group has continuous spectrum with, I should have added, multiplicity 1 over this minus infinity to minus quarter, but also has a rich point spectrum embedded in the continuous spectrum. Now, how, and it is the continuous spectrum that is of interest. Now, how does one prove this theorem? How does one construct the spectral representation? Classically, it is done by constructing an eigenfunction corresponding to the continuous spectrum, that is one that's not quite square integrable, which starts with the one I put down before, but it has to be automorphized. And so, as it stands, it's not an automorphic function, so you have to sum over the group, except you don't sum over the translation with respect to x, because it's already invariant with respect to translation in x. And that's the celebrated Eisenstein series. It doesn't converge if the exponent a is 1/2, converges for the real part over less than minus 1/2. So one has to do an analytic continuation, and it's a very classical theory. Now,
what happens to other values of a? They're not in the continuous spectrum.
They are not in the continuous spectrum.
But they are eigenvalues in some
sense. Well, but they are, the eigenfunctions grow horribly fast. So, this is a, now I would like to show you how much easier it is to construct translation representation. So, in order to construct the translation representation, we need an operator which has, whose spectrum is uniform, the Lebesgue spectrum over the whole real line. So that can be accomplished by taking L, which is just the hyperbolic Laplacian, plus a quarter. So its spectrum presumably is on the whole negative axis. Then take its square root. So that the spectrum of that would be on the positive and negative imaginary axis. So if you take them together, it's a Lebesgue spectrum on the pure imaginary axis, just what we want. Now, however, we take the square root in a different fashion, introduced by Fadeev and Pavlov in 1972. They consider the automorphic, the hyperbolic wave equation, which is UTP minus L of U, and they show how the scattering theory that Ralph Phillips and I have developed applies very neatly to this equation. So, here is how it goes. U of T is the solution operator of the wave equation. So U of T relates the initial data, which consists of U and U sub T at time zero, to data at time T. So, since the equation is hyperbolic equation, there is conservation of energy, and the energy E is obtained in the usual fashion. Because of that term minus U, that negative term, it's not quite positive. The integration by parts doesn't work for automorphic functions. This is a slight technical glitch that I will completely overlook. The generator of this group is BDT acting on UUT, which is UTU second derivative, which can be written as a that matrix, 2x2 matrix. So this is A, and A square is just L twice. So this shows that A is the square root of L, which is what we want. So, and we want the translation representation, that is, represent the initial data by a function S, so that the action of the group is just translation. Nothing is simpler. Well, following Fadeev and Pavlov, we integrate U with respect to X. And here you regard U as being defined in the whole hyperbolic plane. And you get a function from X between minus half plus half. And you get a function that I denote as U bar, and if you integrate the hyperbolic wave equation, the x derivatives integrate away, and you get this equation. And if you introduce a new variable V related to U bar, you get that equation. And if you make a change of variable, replace y by s equals log y, it just becomes a classical one-dimensional wave equation. All this is Fadeev and Pavlov. And that can be factored, and that shows that the function k, which is v sub t minus v sub s, is indeed gives a translation representation. And this function, it has to be divided by square root of 2, can be expressed in terms of v sub t and v sub s, which in terms of the original variables is as follows. Now, we have to show that this is truly a translation representation. That is, we have to show that if you apply this to initial data that give rise to no point eigenfunctions, then this representation is unitary. That is, that the square integral of R is equal to the energy of the data. Now, let me show you how the point spectrum very conveniently disappears. Suppose lambda is a point eigenvalue, so now P is an honest eigenfunction, square integrable over the fundamental domain, and in particular at y equals infinity. So if we integrate the eigenfunction equation with respect to y, we get this equation. And this equation can be solved explicitly. The solution is of the form y to the n, where you just substitute this into the equation, you get this formula for n. It's 1/2 plus minus square root of lambda. And if lambda is negative, remember the eigenvalues are embedded in the continuous spectrum, which is on the negative axis, then the square root of lambda is imaginary. So P bar, which is a linear combination of these, is never square integrable, unless A and B are zero. So that shows that taking the average U bar integrating out X maps the eigenfunctions into zero, which is what we want since we are aiming at the continuous spectrum. So that eliminates the eigenvalues. So, and I formulate that as a lemma, that an eigenfunction p bar is zero. So the main theorem is that if f1 and f2 are initial data which are orthogonal to the point eigenfunctions, then that function r, which was explicitly expressed in terms of the initial data, is a unitary representation of the data. So let me just say a few words. How much time do I have left? 12 minutes. Plenty. Sorry?
7 minutes.
Oh, 7 minutes. Okay. All right. A friend of mine once, similar position, asked how many minutes do I have? Well, he told about. And he said, it just determined the speed with which I talk. But
it is 12 to
All right. So, it starts with the notion of an outgoing solution. Now, what is an outgoing solution? It's one given by that formula where M is a smooth function supported on the positive axis. Now, you can see that this function is as defined in the fundamental domain is non-zero only above the line y equals 1. So it's automorphic. And for it's a solution of the hyperbolic wave equation. It's just a plane wave, or it's a wave moving to the right. So for t positive, this just moves up majestically unchanged. So then I extend this function to the whole plane. In here, and then this is filled up with the reflection of that is this, and then it's a complicated picture of the images of the fundamental domain filling up that space. How complicated it is, we'll figure at the punchline. So, so imagine this function extended to this whole strip between minus 1 and plus 1. And here, I denote that by the extension by u of x, y, and t. Now, the function v, which was, you remember, instead of u, we introduced a new function v, just turns out to be m of s minus t, and therefore, this function k, which I said gives this translation representation, is just twice m prime of s. That's why I have to introduce the 1 over square root of 2. And one can easily show that the square integral of m prime is the energy of the solution. That's just a calculation, one integration by parts. And so, if I denote by d plus the space of outgoing initial data, we have unitarity. The square integral of the representer is indeed equal to the energy. Now, take these outgoing solutions. If you take t to be positive, then you get nothing but translation upward. But if you take t to be negative, then you start getting more complicated solutions. And I denote by H plus the union of these solutions calculated backwards. And the lemma says that this space is dense in the energy norm in the space of all solutions that are orthogonal to the point spectrum. So this is not a trivial result, but I will not present the proof of it. Now, what is the geometric interpretation of the translation representation? And for that, we interpret the fundamental domain by identifying the points which are indeed identical, these two points and this point with these points, and then you get a simply connected two-dimensional manifold. These are slightly singular points, but never mind. And now these integrals that we take, remember, the representer R is defined by integrating the function U. And we do the integration all the way down to y equals 0. Now these lines are called horocycles. They are circles with center at infinity. And up here, they are just circles. But as you get down here, they become more complicated. And thereby hangs a very interesting tale. So this is just what I described here. Now, for the modular group, there is, in addition to the continuous spectrum, a rather rich point spectrum. Now, how to see that? Well, a simple way to see it is to exploit the bilateral symmetry of the fundamental domain F. And this bilateral symmetry splits the function on the fundamental domain into even and odd functions. If you take the odd functions, since on the one hand the value here has to be equal to the value there, on the other hand if it's negative, it follows that they satisfy Dirichlet boundary conditions. And using the Poincaré inequality or Wirtinger's inequality, one can easily show that the resolvent of the Laplacian is compact and therefore has a pure point spectrum. So there's a rich point spectrum. There is even a point spectrum for even functions. Now, so much for the modular group. So I turn now to arbitrary middle-sized groups, gamma, whose fundamental domain could have more than one cusp. A cusp is a point at infinity. For instance, here you have two cusps, here you have three cusps. But the same analysis, the same construction of the translation representation applies. We have a translation representer associated with each cusp, we map that cusp to infinity, then we map this cusp to infinity. So if there are n cusps, there will be n translation representers. Now, and the theorem is the same. If U has n distinct n cusps, it has n distinct translation representers, and if U is orthogonal to the eigenfunctions, then this representation is unitary. So, and the geometric picture of a fundamental domain with three cusps is something like that, and the translation representers are integrals over the horocycles and over the way out in the cusp. These are circles, but they become more complicated as you get inside. Now, in 19... How many minutes?
Four.
Plenty. Phillips conjectured that for generic mid-sized group, there is no point spectrum. And I didn't believe him. And I had very good reason not to believe him. And the reason is this. If it were true, that would mean that you can represent the data of this two-dimensional manifold by n functions of one variable. Now, to represent functions of two variables by functions of one variable, set theoretically it's possible, although it's rather artificial, so I didn't believe it. However, I was wrong, and Phillips and Sarnak and Volpert proved this theorem, modulo a hypothesis which I believe to be true. So it is a fact, or almost a fact, that for a generic discrete group of medium size, there is no point spectrum. So that would mean that if you have a function defined on this two-dimensional manifold whose integral along n one-parameter family of kerns is zero, then the function is zero. Now, how can that be true? Well, it can be true if these families of one-parameter curves are very wiggly. And in the exceptional cases like the modular group, it must be the case that these curves are less wiggly. So, there's a very interesting problem to define what wiggliness means. And to prove the statement that for generic groups, these curves are very wiggly, and for groups defined by arithmetic properties, they are smoother. This is, as I promised at the beginning, a nonlinear problem, and I'll leave you with the question to try to define these terms rigorously and prove these theorems. Thank you.